Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear about a new effort to replace Native American mascots and team names at Wisconsin schools. First, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. President Biden's COVID relief bill is making its way through Congress. The president's picks for cabinet positions are in confirmation hearings with some hurdles and controversy along the way. And the U.S. Senate held its first hearing yesterday looking back at what happened on January 6th and what went wrong during the insurrection at the Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow any of yesterday's hearing about January 6th? What were your impressions? What do you have? What questions do you have still coming out of it? Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson stood out for pushing a different narrative over what happened. Do you have questions about his role and what he's had to say about January 6th? And what kind of investigations do you want to see going forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this hearing on January 6th and security problems there. Who did we hear from, first of all, talking to the Senate committee yesterday?
Well, believe it or not, this was really the first hearing, even though this was, you know, more than a month ago. We heard from the D.C. police chief, the former Capitol police chief, who, of course, left after January 6th, and then the sergeant at arms, both from the House and the Senate. Both of them have also left.
Anita, I'm going to jump in. Anita, we've got a bad connection coming through. We're going to, I think, call you now, and we'll give that a shot. Just it's kind of breaking up here. Sorry about that. In the meantime, you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you want to join our Week in Washington conversation, what do you want to come out of January 6th when it comes to investigating what happened, what went wrong at a security level? Do you want to see a 9/11 style commission look at this? Do you think that there can be a bipartisan look at the events of January 6th? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anita, sorry about that. Take it from the top. Who are we hearing from yesterday?
Sure. We heard from four people, the D.C. police chief. We also heard from three officials who have left, the Capitol police chief, and then the sergeant in arms of the House and the Senate. All three of those people left after the January 6th riots.
And what kind of accounts did we hear? A lot of the people you just mentioned raised concerns, saying that they hadn't gotten enough intelligence briefings. I've seen some skepticism about that. Was there a fair amount of finger pointing going on here?
Yeah, I mean, they contradicted each other and had different timelines and things that didn't match up. But I would say there were a couple things that really stood out from all four of them. One of the things is that they had called the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, and asked for the National Guard to come out. And they say that there was quite a delay, that there was a 2-hour delay even to send them, send guardsmen and women over there because of the optics. They're saying the Department of Defense said that it wouldn't look good to have these military officials at the Capitol. That prompted a lot of questions, as you can imagine, and now senators want to hear from the Pentagon about that. And then the other thing is what you alluded to, is that the intelligence, what happened to the intelligence? Why did they not realize that this could happen on that day? And what we heard was really alarming to some senators, which is basically there was some information out there that the FBI had collected that something could happen to the Capitol on January 6th, but it never got to the right people. So it went to, it was from a office in Virginia, and then it came through the FBI to the District of Columbia, but it never got to the Capitol police chief, is what he's saying. And so they just didn't get that information into the right hands, and they did not realize the Capitol could be breached.
We are talking about some of the top stories in national politics, including the hearings yesterday and going on about the January 6th events. Anita Kumar is with us from Politico. Now, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson got a lot of attention for his testimony. His use of his question time. What kind of things did he have to say that got people's attention?
Yeah, I mean, even the senators there, bipartisan senators, were sort of questioning him. He basically used his time to talk about that who was behind the protest, and he used the words that there were fake Trump protesters. I mean, he basically was saying that the people involved in the protests at the Capitol were not supporters of Donald Trump. And I think it's been clear from everything we've heard so far that that is not the case. Those people that did storm the Capitol, and many have been arrested so far, were supporters of Donald Trump. And of course, the impeachment trial that was just had basically went into detail about how some of these people were following exactly what President Trump was saying. And so they decided to go to the Capitol. It was baffling to a lot of his colleagues, even some Republican members. And you're right, he got a ton of attention for this, basically people complaining that he was using his time to espouse conspiracy theories.
Let's bring on a caller on this at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Two Rivers. Jay, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm really bad at guessing political outcomes. I didn't get the presidential elections since the year 2000, although I pay a lot of attention to NPR and other news feeds, and I just never seem to outguess the voters. But I am going to offer a guess that Ron Johnson is going to run again, because I can't see any other reason why he's trying to out-Trump Trump. His statements recently are just so outlandish, and I just don't know what else to make of it.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot of question here in Wisconsin, Anita, whether Senator Johnson is going to run for a third term. But Jay says he appears to be positioning himself in a very pro-Trump lane, even among his fellow Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we're seeing right now with the Republican Party. Half of the party seems to be, you know, trying to turn the page from Donald Trump, and the other half, including Senator Johnson and Senator Cruz from Texas and Senator Hawley from Missouri, are trying to really be close to him and saying that he still did win the election, and obviously talking about the protests. So there is a split in the party on what that way forward is. And it would make sense that some of them want to stick close to Donald Trump. He's still the leader at this point of the party, and maybe use his supporters to try to get reelected.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Kevin now in northern Wisconsin. Kevin, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to say, yeah, another on Ron Johnson. The Democrats, if he does run next year, they have to work really hard. He's got to go. I mean, he's way out there. I mean, wow, where do you even start with the guy? You know, and it's incredible that he still has so much support in the state, but the state also supported Joe McCarthy. So there you go.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. At the national level, Anita, can you talk about the calculations Republicans, not just Ron Johnson, are making as they, you know, look at reelection, risks of primary attacks in effect by Trump supporters if they don't go along those lines?
Yeah, President Trump has made it clear that once the impeachment trial ended, that he was going to be more vocal. If you'll remember, when he left Washington on January 20th, he'd been pretty quiet for the last month or so. And now we expect him to really start speaking out and talking about Republicans and talking about the Republicans that are not supportive of him. And I think there's still some fear in the Republican Party that they just don't want to go against Donald Trump, and they don't want to face that. Now, of course, Donald Trump doesn't have his Twitter feed like he used to, but, you know, he can still talk publicly, and we're going to see him have his first his first speech just in the next few days. So I think there's some concern about that. But look, they're also, Republicans across the country are also looking at the fact that Donald Trump got 70 million plus votes on Election Day. And now some of those people would have voted for any Republican candidate because they are just Republicans. But some of them really do support Donald Trump, and they still do. And so there's a fear that if you're not supportive of Donald Trump, you won't get some of those votes. And so there is some calculus, there's some thinking that, you know, you could be, you know, you want the support of Donald Trump's supporters.
I want to give a listen before we move on to those hearings. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat, talking at the conclusion of the proceedings. Here's a listen.
There is clear agreement that this was a planned insurrection. So, and I think most members here are very firmly agree with that. And I think it's important for the public to know that. This was planned. We now know this was a planned insurrection. It involved white supremacists. It involved extremist groups. And it certainly could have been so much worse except for the bravery of the officers.
And Anita, before we move on from the issue, what do we know about attempts to get a commission in place to investigate more fully?
Yeah, the Democrats are really pushing towards this, and the White House hasn't said they're opposed. But we are hearing some concerns by Republican members about what the makeup would be. So I think there is a thought that this is going to happen, sort of like they had a commission after the September 11th attacks, that kind of thing. And they're sort of working through how that would work, who would be on that commission, and what exactly they would do.
We're talking to Anita Kumar from Politico. It's the Week in Washington. We're talking about several top stories in national politics. Coming up, a look at President Biden's cabinet nominations, where they stand. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've seen of the cabinet nominations from the new White House? How do you think they've been treated? If you've been following the confirmation hearings, what questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Anita, let's get into cabinet appointments now, some going swimmingly, some in jeopardy. What kind of Senate confirmations are you paying the closest attention to?
Well, I think the biggest one right now, of course, is the one that's in jeopardy, and that is Neera Tanden, who was nominated to be the head of the budget office. So it's a cabinet-level position, not one of those cabinet secretaries people might hear about. She lost the support of one Democrat that we know of, and as you know, the Senate is split 50-50. She would need to pick up support from a Republican to win that confirmation. What happened today is that the Senate, two Senate committees that are looking at her nomination, the Homeland Security and Budget Committees, sent out notices today saying that they're going to postpone their vote and that they're trying to get some more support for her before they do that vote. It does look like her nomination is in peril.
What have been the objections to her as the OMB director?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I'll tell you that the senators are saying it's because she has been extremely partisan in the past. She is on Twitter or has been on Twitter a lot. She's also been on television quite a lot, where she's basically been criticizing Republicans. And they're saying, how can, you know, President Biden say he wants to work with Republicans when he has nominated someone who has been extremely critical of Republican senators? Senators, she's now asking basically to vote for her. So that's the reason that they're giving. I'll say that, you know, different groups, women's groups and others have said, look, it's because she's a woman. It's a double standard. You have some people saying it's because of her background. She's Asian American, actually Indian American. Both of her parents are from India, though she was born here. So they're saying, look, people of color and women have a harder time getting their nomination through than others.
And could you talk about some of the other cases where people of color up for Senate confirmation are facing a rockier road than some others?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting because a lot of the ones that got delayed, not all of them, but some of them were people of color. So we saw the Homeland Security Secretary, who did get through and was confirmed. There was some delay. We've seen the Interior Secretary also have a delay. You know, all of them look pretty much like they're going through. We saw a hearing this week for the Attorney General, who also was delayed but is not a person of color, Merrick Garland, and that looks like it's going to go through just fine. I think the only other one that we're really looking at is the Interior Secretary. She's actually Native American, and her nomination or her confirmation would be historic, and there are a lot of the same people supporting her that are supporting Neera Tanden. We haven't gotten close to that enough to know what that vote is going to look like. We do know that Joe Manchin, who is the Democrat from West Virginia who opposed Neera Tanden or is opposing her, has said he is going to vote for her. So hers looks like it's a slightly easier, and really in Washington, all eyes are on the Neera Tanden nomination.
I've seen some people jokingly refer to Senate Majority Leader Joe Manchin, who is not, of course, the actual Senate Majority Leader, but as a likely swing vote on confirmations and who knows what else, may have a lot of sway over what gets through this 50-50 Senate, right?
It's totally true. I mean, it's really remarkable. The moderates, particularly him, are really key right now. I mean, you kind of know where the Republicans are going to be generally. You kind of know where the Democrats, there are very few moderates, both Republicans and Democrats, right there in the middle, that are really going to decide both nominations, but they're also going to decide policies and legislation as it goes forward. Now, it is 50-50. Of course, the Vice President, Kamala Harris, is a Democrat, so she can break that tie, but just one vote either way can really make the difference.
Talking to Anita Kumar from Politico, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Well, you mentioned policy items before Congress. Here's this COVID relief bill from the president. Doesn't look like it's going to hit that 60-vote threshold in the Senate, but they don't need it because they're using reconciliation. Where is that right now?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, President Biden had talked, you know, before he was sworn in about trying to get Republican support. He feels that it's very important. It's something that he, you know, tried to do when he was in the Senate all those years ago. But what he's finding is just opposition to this bill by Republicans. And so they've decided to use this budget maneuver that you mentioned, reconciliation, which basically means they can move forward with a simple majority instead of 60 in the Senate. So they are moving forward with that. They are basically saying, the White House is saying, and Democrats are saying that they want to move forward. They hope that Republicans will be on their side. But if not, they're going to move ahead because they feel like this money is needed. And of course, this package is huge. It's $1.9 trillion, almost $2 trillion. And it's everything. It's money for testing and the vaccine to get out. But it's also direct payments to Americans and money for schools. So they're very eager for all of that to get through. Now, we don't know that every single thing could to get through. There's a couple things that we're just not positive will make it. The president's talked about he wants to increase the minimum wage, and that may not make it. But most of the pieces probably could get through without this Republican support.
And on the Republican side, a lot of polling at this point shows a lot of public support, majority at least public support for this package. Republicans hoping to chip away at that and not likely, it looks like many of them, to break ranks and vote for this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, generally in Washington, you see the closer to the election, they might be willing to vote for something like this. But there are Republicans who are just, you know, even though there is American support for this, they are saying that they're not going to. Now, the Republicans have said, some of them, that they are supportive of a bill. They just think this is entirely too big. There are also disagreements on what they should spend money on. So, for example, one of the sticking points for months, even before this new Congress, even last year, was that Democrats really want money to go to state and local governments. Remember, state and local governments get their money from people eating out and shopping and taxes, and obviously people haven't been doing that. So they want to get that money to them, and Republicans don't support that. So it's not just the price tag, it's what the money is going to and the price tag. And there are Republicans who have said they want a smaller one, maybe a third of the size. And Democrats are just saying no. The White House is saying absolutely not. That's too small.
I want to spend our last couple of minutes, Anita, on something you wrote about lately. President Biden weighing some options on gun safety. What kind of measures is he looking at?
Well, this is a tough one. It's been a tough one for years now because it's hard to get anything through the Senate, particularly now because it's so split. The president is looking at executive orders that he can do. He's also looking at backing legislation. One of the things that we heard he's likely to do is ask for a rule from his administration to regulate things that are called ghost guns, which are something that has become popular in recent years. They're basically makeshift, homemade almost, guns that you can buy online or in a store where you make them at your home. They aren't regulated as firearms, and he would like those to be regulated. But they're also looking at a variety of other things, including a significant amount of money for community-based groups and communities of color to sort of try to prevent gun violence, not just mass shootings, but everyday gun violence that we hear about. It's still quite far away from a proposal, though, and that's making some people very frustrated. They thought that he would come into office with a plan on how to curb gun violence, and we're just not there yet.
And the Biden administration in a position, you know, it's a tough issue to get things done on guns one way or the other, but also a COVID package, cabinet appointments, and more. Is there just so much stuff that is going to crowd out that part of his agenda?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they will get to it, and they very much are supportive, but you're exactly right. They are concentrating on this COVID relief package. It's their number one priority, and they're not going to do anything else legislatively, try to push through anything else until they get that done. Another point, though, is that they don't even have a confirmed attorney general yet. They will very soon here, but they also don't have a director of the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency. So they need to get a lot of these people in place before they can come up with a plan.
Anita, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. We talked to her about several top Washington political stories, including a Senate hearing investigating the security breach at the Capitol on January 6th and confirmation hearings for President Biden's cabinet nominees. Coming up after the news, Governor Tony Evers wants to give schools incentives to change their Native American mascots. We'll find out what's in the works and hear from a supporter of that idea. Want to say thank you before I forget to everyone who gave during our member drive over the last week or so. I was off yesterday, didn't get to thank you right off the bat, but really do appreciate your support. You're stepping up again to help Wisconsin Public Radio and for all of your kind comments along the way. It's a really great time to hear from you. So again, thanks. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, more schools are working on plans for in-person learning this school year. Hear perspectives from teachers and superintendents and join in with your thoughts. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Next up on Central Time, we'll hear about a plan to fund changes to schools' Native American mascots. First, what if you call 911 and no one comes? That's a problem facing several towns in northern Wisconsin after they lost their ambulance service provider at the beginning of the year. Towns are mandated to provide emergency services unless they're offered elsewhere. But as Danielle Kading reports, rural communities are struggling to provide that service because of a lack of volunteers, long distances, and inadequate financing.
Bud Rubeck never saw him coming. He and his wife, Julie, had gone over to a neighbor's house late one night in Clam Lake to try to smooth things over between a fighting couple. Instead, the man blindsided him, punching Rubeck on the left side of his head. He fell and hit the ground hard.
When the ambulance service got here, had we not had critical care paramedics, I would have been dead.
Great Divide Ambulance Service and Cable was there to respond when his life was on the line. Paramedics took him to Cable, where they were met by a helicopter. He was flown to a hospital in Duluth, where he spent several days on life support. He left after a month and had to learn to walk all over again. But now, if someone dials 911 in Clam Lake, he says there's no guarantee anyone will answer.
We're on our own.
Clam Lake recently lost its ambulance service after Great Divide decided not to renew contracts with six towns in Ashland County. Some have found service, but several others have not. Great Divide's Rob Poles says the ambulance service struggled with overtime costs and other mounting expenses. But the biggest issue was staffing.
And in a pandemic, situation. There aren't people lining up to be first responders right now.
The town of Gordon is one of the places left in the lurch. Chairman Doug Thorpe asked every surrounding agency if they would contract to respond, but they all pointed to a lack of staff or the distance. It could take some up to 45 minutes to respond one way.
That just leaves us kind of in the middle of the woods with no ambulance service.
While services like Great Divide pay staff, more than 90% of Wisconsin fire departments rely on volunteers like Mellon Fire and Rescue. The fire and ambulance outfit is nearby towns that lost service. But Fire Chief Tony Huber says they may not be able to answer every call because they have a small staff of just under a dozen volunteers.
The younger generation does not want to do this stuff. You look up here in northern Wisconsin, there's not a lot of younger people sticking around, for one thing.
Like many rural areas, northern Wisconsin has a shrinking and aging population that makes it difficult to find volunteers. Gordon and other towns reached out to the Ashland Fire Department last fall. Ashland has the closest service with a paid staff.
Most of them are gone right now. We have had a terribly busy day today.
That's Fire Chief David Wegener. On the day we meet up, he says they had five calls in about 20 minutes. One ambulance was just returning from transferring a patient to the hospital. Wegener says they have to weigh their call volume and staffing when they get requests to provide service. He says they're now responding to one nearby town that lost service, but that doesn't make sense for communities farther away.
And when you take into account weather conditions and the roads and such, not only does that place the patient at risk, but it places our staff at risk as well.
Long distances increase the need for highly skilled staff that can provide critical care in the field. But Thorpe and Huber say the necessary training and testing are barriers for volunteers. They think the state should ease a testing requirement for first responders to get certified. Republican lawmakers have reintroduced a bill to do just that. But John Ike, who directs the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, fears that pits the need for volunteers against patient care.
People are only doing this because they're feeling desperate. And this is why we need to address this with more serious solutions.
Ike and others think state or local governments should pay people to respond, rather than relying on volunteers. But town officials argue their ability to raise revenue is limited. Bud Rubeck doesn't know the best solution, but he hopes to see one soon, as the COVID-19 virus remains a risk for older residents.
With everything that's going on, I just think it's important that we get this figured out
before the next time someone dials 911. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Governor Evers' budget plan aims to help schools change their Native American mascots. The proposal would set aside $400,000 of tribal casino revenues to help fund those changes. Schools would get this money in the form of grants. About 6% of the state's school districts use Native American images as mascots and nicknames like Chiefs, Warriors, and Redmen. Critics say they promote stereotypes that hurt Native American students. The Republican-led Joint Finance Committee has not said if the proposal would survive in the final spending plan. You can join in on this topic at 800-642-1234. Do you think those remaining school districts should change their Native American team names and mascots and logos? Do you feel like you've been harmed by what they promote? Do you feel that you have one in your community that maybe honors Native Americans in some ways? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Trisha Zunker is president of the Wausau School Board and a member of Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation. She was a former Democratic candidate for Congress. Trisha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Rob.
We've seen efforts in the past, Trisha, to just flat out ban the use of these logos, and those ended up getting overturned later. What do you think of this idea of incentivizing school districts to help them pay for the cost of changing these logos and mascots?
Well, that happens to be one of the arguments that they tend to raise, is the cost. So that eliminates that argument. And Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribes, each with their own customs, traditions, governments, languages, and sovereignty. Continued use of race-based mascots, symbols, nicknames, and imagery in our public schools perpetuates stereotypes of Native Americans, and it is never good educational policy to stereotype against an entire race of people. So I commend Governor Evers for his focus on strengthening educational policy in our public schools with this proposed amount.
Do you see kind of the tide turning on this issue with a very high profile, what's now known as the Washington football team in the NFL, finally changing their team name after many years of criticism? Do you think that that is leading to renewed attention even at the local school level?
Well, I think it certainly helps further the discussion. I mean, to be frank, the Washington football team didn't make the change because of social justice, though. They made the change because of the billions of dollars of ad and advertisers that were going to pull out from advertising and investing. So that's what they were listening to, not the 50 years of tribal leaders, activists, and allies. However, I am glad that they did change the name. Because this is something that doesn't just hurt Native Americans. The credible peer-reviewed research demonstrates that their continued use undermines the educational experience of all students. It exacerbates cross-community conflict and creates a hostile learning environment for Native students that can have lifelong detrimental effects.
Yeah, the American Psychology Association says school districts should remove these mascots. They point towards psychological harm for Native American students because of stereotyping. Can you talk about how that can affect, as you mentioned, not just Native American students, but others as well?
Well, it just creates this idea of what a Native American looks like, how we dress, and it just perpetuates false notions. It just creates a misunderstanding of who we are in the community, and they're just very damaging. And yes, the APA has that resolution from 2005 when they called for immediate retirement. There's also documented research that was published just last year, even more robust, furthering those findings on how damaging it is because of the various forms of injustice that Native American students face in schools, including racial slurs, the stereotyping, micro-assaults, and even culturally insensitive school policies and practices. So we really need to get to part of the root of the problem, and that is when you create this cartoonish image, you create a false sense of what a Native American is, that contributes detrimentally to the Native American experience in schools, but again, to everybody. It's not a welcoming environment.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that I live on the land. I actually reside on the land that was stolen from the Menominee Nation. So I stand with you, Tricia. I think all of these names should be changed because we as a white race do not honor and respect the indigenous people. I mean, that was just proven with this wolf hunt where the indigenous people weren't even notified of this. So I think they all need to be changed, and we, the white race, need to start learning to respect and honor our indigenous native peoples.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Tricia?
Well, I really want to thank Cindy for calling in and her comments, too. And that is an argument that is often raised, too. There are districts that say, oh, we do this as a form of honoring Native Americans. But it's not true. If school districts truly want to honor Native Americans, then they should ensure the requirements of Act 31 are fully and accurately met in their districts. Act 31, of course, is the law that was enacted after all of the spearfishing controversies of the late 80s. And it was just widely known that people didn't understand, the general population didn't understand treaty rights and usufructuary rights and why the Ojibwe population, Ojibwe people, had these specific rights in northern Wisconsin. And it was creating such controversy. I was growing up here in Wausau at the time, and I had bad experiences at school even as a result of that, from what other students were hearing in their households and then coming back and saying to me and my brother. Well, anyway, Act 31 was enacted to ensure that in our public schools, students in the elementary levels learn about all 11 tribes twice in the elementary years and once in the secondary years. But it is well known, even DPI acknowledges and Wisconsin Association of School Boards, that Act 31 is not being complied with. So that is a first step to truly honoring Native Americans, is making sure that public school districts fully and accurately comply with Act 31.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We're looking at efforts to change Native American school mascots. Here in Wisconsin, Tricia Zunker is with us, president of the Wausau School Board and member of Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation. Governor Evers' budget proposal includes funding to help schools who do make that decision, the schools that still have Native American mascots. The budget proposal, anyway, would provide funding to help them with the cost of that name change. You could join in at 800-642-1234. is the school in your community one of the schools we're talking about here with a Native American themed or related mascot or team nickname or logo? Have there been discussions about that in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And what do you think about the idea of, I guess, a carrot incentive, providing funding to make these changes instead of attempted bans as we've seen in the past? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Tricia Zunker, president of the Wausau School Board and a member of Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation, about renewed attention on schools whose mascots and names reference Native Americans. Governor Evers, in his budget proposal, aims to fund schools who still have those nicknames in their efforts to change those and cover some of the costs of changing logos and things like that. You could join in with your thoughts on that idea at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to see schools, the remaining schools with Native American themed mascots, names, and logos, change them? What do you think of the idea of the state picking up some of the tab for doing that? Has this been an issue in your own community, in your own school district? And what questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Again, Tricia, this new effort, this proposal from Governor Evers incentivizes changing names. Would you be supportive of another attempt to just flat out have the state ban the use of these names at schools?
Well, I think it's time to make the change. And even before these national teams were making changes between the Washington team and Cleveland, we saw the changes were starting here in Wisconsin last year when Wausau School Board submitted the resolution urging retirement of this practice. One of the things that we did is I went around the state and I asked other school boards to join in. I thought, you know, we thought that it would have a greater impact, a bigger voice to have more districts on board. And so before we started that work, there were 31 districts in Wisconsin that still retained the mascots, nicknames, images, symbols, and logos. And now today there are 27. And so there are state or there are districts that have made the change. And the result is that thousands upon thousands of students will no longer be subjected to essentially interscholastic discrimination. Because another common argument that is made is that this should be a local control issue. The problem, though, is that these mascots and nicknames and imagery, they don't stay confined within the district boundaries. Other students, other people are exposed to them unwillingly through scholastic events, athletic events, clothing throughout the state. And so it really is an interscholastic discrimination, and it does need to end.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on these issues. Tricia, you mentioned the concept that people say these team names and mascots honor Native Americans. If a school genuinely wanted to honor Native Americans, in addition to the teaching you mentioned earlier, I mean, are there public ways that you think would be more appropriate than the names and the logos and the mascots?
Sure. I mean, they can absolutely reach out to tribes near them, ask for some education, perhaps some guest speakers, perhaps some policies to encourage students and staff to attend cultural events like powwows. They're always open to everybody. Those are other ways to honor and to just take it upon themselves to learn about the struggles that still exist today. One problem is, you know, on the one hand, we've got these cartoonish images that create stereotypes. And on the other end, we have essentially invisibility of Native Americans. That's a new racism against Native Americans. And so just kind of understanding that we are still here and that there are continued struggles, whether it's disproportionate rates of suicide, drug use, substance abuse, poverty, unemployment. There's a lot of struggles in the Native community, and to just be aware and to try and learn the history accurately.
Let's go back to our callers now. Teresa is with us in Lac des Flambeaux. Teresa, hi.
Hi. My name is Teresa Subral, and I'll get you that quick. I'm an Anishinaabeg Menominee, and I'm around where the wolf hunt is right now, but I am calling because of, she's doing a wonderful job, absolutely wonderful. But yes, the mascots need to go. It causes a lot of problems. The youth do tend to take on their stereotypes and ideologies of what us females look like, and a lot of sexualizing ends up happening. For the indigenous youth that are going to schools away from the reserves and never get to come home yet, this is what they're being shown as, and it's shameful. You don't want to go home. You don't know what to expect in when you're seeing that, and this is what's being taught. But in Red Lake, Minnesota, I had learned a lesson up there with the dogs, and it was investment. And when people invest a little bit, they become involved. And so to have the communities invest as well in the changing over, to be involved in doing the right thing and why we're doing it, and what do we think we should be doing? It's educational institutions. So what does inspire us? You know, what makes us feel strong in these times?
Teresa, thanks a lot for the call. Tricia, your thoughts on what Teresa's saying, have the community, getting community support for the change and getting people excited about a change like this?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of community support if you're talking about the Native community, but also allies that recognize this change is overdue, that the practice is harmful, it's destructive. And I'm really glad that Teresa touched on another aspect here, which is the dehumanization that occurs with these mascots and the connection that can be made with our crisis of missing and murdered and Indigenous women. This is a crisis in this country. We have missing and murdered Indigenous women in this state. And we can go back and look at the fact that mascots dehumanize Native Americans. And what does it mean if you have a misunderstanding or see somebody as less than human, as subhuman, and the fact that there is a willingness perhaps to be more violent to somebody that you don't see as equal, as human. So I think that's really an important point to address as well, is the correlation that could be there.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Jeff now in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hello. This is Jeff calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I just want to say thank you. I love your show. And Tricia, thank you for all your work. I'm an educator here in the city of Milwaukee. I'm also a father of two children in the Milwaukee public school system. And I am completely in favor of the proposal. Nevertheless, I haven't truly read over it. I would want to make sure that the education components are coupled with the removal of any type of mascot or image that's inappropriate. I feel that sometimes when there isn't an equal amount of money invested in the education process, it creates a great deal of cynicism in the public, and rightly so.
Jeff, I'm going to jump in because you just have a few moments left. Tricia, education, Jeff is saying, to go along with these changes in the communities that still have these mascots and logos and team names.
Well, I think that's absolutely important. And like I said, we already know that the requirements of Act 31 aren't being met generally throughout the state. You should reach out to your specific district and see how they're doing it. But this is something that's lacking just to begin with. But to couple that in the proposal, I think would be a very worthwhile and I would effort. I would definitely support that.
Thanks for the call. And Tricia, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. Pina Gigi.
Tricia Zunker is president of the Wausau School Board, a member of Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation. She talked to us about Governor Evers' budget proposal aimed at helping schools remove Native American mascots, team names, and logos. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a physician makes the case that progress with COVID vaccines could bring life back to normal sooner than we think. The federal deficit has seen a big jump in recent years, from a big tax cut to the huge impacts of COVID-19 and relief bills. A budget expert joins the show for a look at the long-term impact. And online dating apps are playing a bigger role these days. The author of a new book shares advice on navigating the new world of dating. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. There's some big news from the world of biology with a special connection to this show. Well, to me, anyway. Scientists with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced last week the first successful cloning of a U.S. endangered species, a black-footed ferret. As reported by the AP, the cloned ferret, named Elizabeth Ann, was born in December in Colorado. The cloning was part of an ongoing effort to help reintroduce the endangered black-footed ferret, once thought to be completely extinct. Elizabeth Ann was cloned from a ferret that died 30 years ago. That ferret's DNA was preserved because there wasn't much genetic diversity remaining. Elizabeth Ann had a surrogate mom, a domestic ferret, but the scientists point out that the black-footed variety tends to be, understandably, a wilder species than her domestic cousins, so not great pets. There's some controversy about the idea of reviving actually extinct species by cloning. That's something more likely to happen with a passenger pigeon than, say, a T-Rex. But there's a growing interest in the idea of using cloning to preserve endangered species impacted by humans, like these ferrets. If we're going to start cloning ferrets in particular, if we could clone a Rob ferret, it would make it a lot easier for me to take some days off. But I'm not sure how well I'd get along with the guy. It's ferret news you can use. This is Central Time.